Greetings, everyone, and welcome back to the Mark Fraley Podcast. Today is October 22nd, 2021, a chilly and somewhat overcast Friday morning here in Nashville. Cooler weather is definitely with us. I've been thinking lately about the character of the wonderful people who listen frequently to this podcast. Friends who share an interest in parks and in the outdoors and gardening and native plants, in folklore and cultural and family history, in the personal stories of leaders in the parks and conservation movement. Over the past few weeks, I've heard from many of you, and I do appreciate the positive and encouraging comments you've made. I do have some interesting future programs in the works that I hope you'll enjoy. Environmental and sustainability activists frequently assert that the jobs of the future will be green jobs, and that there will be an abundance of work for people doing such things as installing solar panels and retrofitting dwellings to be more energy efficient. I've no doubt that this is true if we work to make it happen. For sure, there are entrepreneurial opportunities in the green economy sector. Yesterday, I had the opportunity to have a conversation with one individual who is truly working to make this happen. Our guest today is John Seymour, president of Roundstone Native Seeds in Upton, Kentucky. For over 20 years, John and his team have been growing high-quality seeds for native plants suited to the eastern United States. These are seeds for grasses and forbs, which are necessary to actually do the land conservation projects which many of us envision. John is a true conservationist with an exquisite knowledge of native plants and agronomy. I think his is a fascinating story and an example of what can be accomplished with desire, imagination, and hard work. So I hope you'll enjoy this interview with John Seymour of Roundstone Native Seeds. So John Seymour, welcome to the Mark Fraley Podcast.
Good morning, Mark. I'm glad to be here today.
John, I'm thrilled to get a chance to speak with you and really looking forward to the information that you have to provide today. Just for my audience, I'm in Nashville recording this, and you are in Upton, Kentucky. Is that right?
Yes, sir. Actually, I live in a little town called Priceville, Kentucky. I'm the last man on the Upton postal route. So Upton's actually in Hardin County, and I live in Hart. I hail from Roundstone Creek in Priceville, but my address is Upton. Pretty close.
Generally speaking, that's up in the cave land area of Kentucky, Horse Cave and around in through there.
Yes, sir. I'm actually a little bit more north of that. That's south of the Green River.
And
that's,
okay.
I'm west of the railroad track, so I'm in the rough ground. Not that pretty ground at Horse Cave, but
I got you. I got you. So if you're going up 65 from Nashville up toward Louisville, you'd be on the left side of the interstate.
Probably about 7-8 miles as a crow flies from the interstate.
Gotcha. Well, that's interesting to know because my wife and I travel back and forth to Cincinnati quite a bit. My mother and brothers and sisters live there. We might stop by to see you one of these days when we're on our
We'd be glad to have you. We encourage visitors of all sorts.
Super. John, I want to spend our time talking today about what you're doing at your business called Roundstone Seed. It's a remarkable story, I think, to see what you're doing in the space of conservation and environmental science and farming, which is kind of an interesting intersection of interests. And I want to get to that. But as we start, tell us a little bit about yourself. And how you got to where you are?
All right, I'd be happy to. My family's been living here in Hart County, Kentucky, for a little over 200 years. So five generations back, my fifth great grandfather John Seymour walked through the Cumberland Gap, and he settled here in Hart County. And that's on my dad's side, and on his mother's side, they've been here almost equally as long. And my mother's people from Barron County, so we've got a long history of being here. And for the most part, my family were carpenters and farmers and stonemasons. My daddy's people came from Scotland to build the bridges in Mumfordville. The My part of my family farm is where the Battle of Munkerville was fought, in Woodsonville, Kentucky. So they were the stonemasons that came to build those bridges. And then at one point they were hired to blow them up, and then hired to build them back and blow them up. We've been around a pretty good while. So we've been tending the same farm ground for a really long time. I grew up as a beef cattle and a tobacco farmer. My dad, he grew up here too. I don't know that he necessarily had the affinity for farming as I did. It was more a hard-pressed labor upon him. My granddaddy was a fine man, but he could sure teach somebody how to work, and he did it in a coarse way, we'll say.
Oh, I see.
So my dad grew up in Woodsonville, Kentucky, which is just south of the river, closer to Horse Cave, like we just talked about.
Right.
And his mother's people were from a little town called Northtown, and a lot of that resides in where Mammoth Cave National Park is now.
I see.
So his people, or my grandmother's people, were kind of subsistence livers. They did all kinds of work, but they also lived off the land. They always were hunting, they were always fishing, and they were always in the woods, and they were using plants. So my dad went to the woods with his grandparents and my grandmother, and he learned plants from an early age, and he had a love for them. But when he finally got his comeuppance and he went to work, he started woodworking factories in eastern Tennessee in the mountains. And he did fairly well at that, and he worked really hard. And I think he just burned out in his mid-40s. And so he sold out, and we moved back home to the farm. And he'd been accumulating farms from the mid-1970s in a rougher part of our county where we live.
Now, what do you mean accumulating farms?
Well, it was our farm is a patchwork where I live now of a lot of small farms. And in the 20s, a lot of people just left. You know, they just had a cow. They had some rows of potatoes. They had a small house. And it was just really hard to make a living here. So a lot of those farms came up for sale.
I see.
We bought several farms and put them together over time. So, and that brings us to where we're at right now, which is Ryder's Mill Farms, is where I grew up at. But my dad, growing up in the woods, knowing plants, he burned out, he sold his business out. We moved back home, and he took off 1 year. And during that year, he went to Mammoth Cave National Park, and he walked a little over 900 miles that year on the trails. Every day he marked and logged how far he went. And he wrote a book, The Wildflowers of Mammoth Cave. So he was able to take his love and his passion and go focus on something. And so because of that, he became a little more well-known in circles of things like the Nature Conservancy and the State Nature Preserves, Departments of Fish and Wildlife, and he was asked to speak. And once his book was published, that became a little more in the forefront too.
Is that book still in print, I wonder?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
And so he has a love for that, and that's what he did. And at that time,
and your pop's name is?
Is Randy Seymour.
Randy Seymour, okay.
William Seymour. So while this is going on, I'm in high school and college, and I'm doing most of the farming. We didn't have a lot of help, but I told him to hang on until he could find somebody, and I would pick up all I could. And so I just kept picking up and doing more and more. And I started raising all the tobacco, about 45,000 pounds of tobacco a year, 120 cows, or custom rolled hay. I was a logger in the wintertime. And then when we got a few minutes, we'd go deer hunting. And the thing about hunting deer or turkey or whatever we did, he was always wanting me to ID plants. So when I'm walking on the trail, I wanted to see deer. And he's like, "What's that, boy?" And I couldn't remember. So I was forced to learn plants at that time in my life.
Fantastic. Fantastic.
I love it. I'm so grateful to get to know everything I do about them, even though that's probably not that much in the grand scheme of things compared to some botanists, that sort of thing. So I tell you all that to tell you this. So my dad grew up loving plants, and I grew up loving them too. And if I can reference back just a little bit further, as late as the late 1700s, 1790s or so, where I live at is part of the Big Barrens region. So that goes everywhere from Breckinridge County all the way down Hart County, Greene County, down into
Barron County, of course.
Barron County, absolutely. And Christian and Todd and all those areas. So we have references and diaries that we know of from people like Francois André Michel. And I don't know if you're familiar with him, Mark, but his dad was André Michel, and he was commissioned by the King of France to do a botanical survey of the whole eastern U.S. And he did that. But his son, the one I'm speaking of, Francois André Michel, followed in his daddy's footsteps. Mm-hmm. And he did a similar job with one caveat. He was also a Jesuit priest.
Oh, my.
So not only was he passionate about plants, but he was also passionate about the good Lord. So he was traveling the countryside, and in his diaries, he talks about going through all this hardwood forest. And then he comes into a savanna, which a savanna is a grassland with an open expanse with trees. And that savanna got more distant and larger trees and fewer dispersed. And then he comes into an area that he travels 60 miles wide by 100 miles long. And that is the Big Barrens region. And in his diary, he talks about an area that's completely devoid of trees. He didn't see any. And then he starts naming off places like Bearwalla, which is right around where my mother was born. Places like Bacon Creek Settlement, which is now Bonneville, Kentucky, which is 6 miles from my house right on the interstate.
Yes.
He describes those places just being prairies, the same kind of tall grass prairies that we have in the Midwest. And so that's why we have what we have. I keep teasing about I live in the rough part, but I'm glad I do, because a lot of it was unable to be plowed. So we have these remnant stands of native grasses and wildflowers and wetland plants. And these are all plants my dad knows. And here I'm struggling farming. And I can't tell you how good my mom and dad worked to me growing up. We were 50-50 split on farming. And at one time in my life, I realized, you know what, we are 50-50.
No, wait. What do you mean a 50-50 split?
So we're supposed to, I do the work, he has the land, and you know, if the income's there, then we split the income.
That was the agreement between the two of y'all. I got it.
But as a young, naive man, one day I woke up and I started putting pencil to paper and thinking, well, I'm costing him money. He didn't tell me that side of things. You know, he's just trying to help me. But you don't want to make a living and cost your parents. Nobody wants to do that. So I was looking to diversify. And I went and looked at this big field. I was going to try and rent it and put some alfalfa out on it, maybe start raising it. I wanted to be a big-time farmer. I want big equipment and all this cool stuff that I saw. And most of mine was, my equipment was pretty rough, pretty shoddy. And we walked out in that field and he said, good gosh, son. He said, this is Indian grass. I didn't know what it was, but we looked at it and he said, you know, the seed is valuable. He said, this is used in conservation programs. And this is what was here in the Grand Prairies and the Big Barren region and all this stuff. And we talk about it. And I wasn't naive to what the prairies were or the plants. I just didn't know it specifically and that it could be utilized for something. And so we went that day and we got 5 gallon buckets and we timed ourselves and we started hand stripping seed, just picking it off to see how many pounds we could get in an hour if we could do that. And we were able to do that. And we figured out that there was need for it for conservation programs like the Conservation Reserve Program, mm-hmm. which is a federal program, mm-hmm. Department of Fish and Wildlife programs, restoration, mitigation, and those sort of things. So from that day with picking with 5 gallon buckets, we went back and we got all we could. And Indian grass was the first species I ever picked, and one that was from the Big Barrens region. So it is that ecotype. It is what was here. I learned that that farm had been plowed in 27 years ago this year is when we did that. And that farm had been plowed 20 years prior to that, and nothing was ever put on it again. So it was just what came up there. So I know it was.
It was in the seed bank, native right to the soil there.
Absolutely. And there were a lot of other forbs and wildflowers mixed in with that.
Sure.
So from that time, we took that seed and I planted it back. And over the years, I would have to take some seed out of production and put natives in. It was about a 5-year process before we had anything. 3 years before I ever sold the first.
So tell me what year this was. This was 1980s or 70s or?
It'd be late, early 90s.
Okay, I got
early
it.
Early 90s. So 27 years ago this year.
Okay.
Is when that happened. So what I didn't tell you was that I did go to school for agriculture and forestry. So I went for ag mech. I'm a machine guy. Machines are my weakness. I love them, but I couldn't afford them. So
agricultural mechanics.
Yes, ag mech.
I got it.
So I took old machines and I cannibalized them and I just made different machines out of them. Conventional machines wouldn't work for what we did for those sorts of things. You know, when we deal with things like wheat or oats, it came from Turkey initially and it was 7 to 9 feet tall. But we bred it to be really short and have a rigid stem and to yield all this seed. But native grasses, most grasses, they're big biomass producers. So I harvest things that are 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 feet tall at times. So I have to make the machinery do that. So I started out on a shoestring budget.
You can't go to the co-op and purchase one of those.
No, absolutely. But what I did get, I didn't give much for to get me started. Like I say, it was some of it was old 1952 Alice Chamworth all crop harvesters that were pulled with a small tractor and that sort
sure,
of thing.
Sure.
So we had this Big Barrens region. We had all these remnants. Me and my dad, we went out and we started handpicking them. And we knew what the history was, why it was here, what we had. And then we also learned that what we have in the East, our ecotypes, are different from what's out West. Yes, you can buy a lot of the same types of plants that we raise in the Midwest and in the Northeast and in Minnesota. You can buy it all over. But the difference is that ours has evolved under our rainfall, our temperatures, our climate, our insects, our soils. And so what we have, for the most part, is better biomass producing plants because we have that 52 inches of rainfall versus the 17 inch in, say, the Midwest. So there's differences. There's differences in times of the plants flowering, when the pollinators hit them, like for the migratory cycle of the monarchs. All of it makes a difference.
So if you're speaking, for instance, of a grass called like Little Blue Stem or Big Blue Stem, the same species, but the genotype that you're dealing with is better adapted to this particular area.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Now, do those differences show out in DNA analysis or anything like that, or are they just practical?
No, it absolutely shows out in DNA analysis.
Okay.
There's been a lot of work done in the coastal plain, the Jones Ecological Research Center and Clemson University. So it goes from west to east. I mean, you can see wind pollinated species, what's further east has more genetic diversity than what's in the west.
So that's fascinating.
It is. It's really cool. So there's limits to where we do everything, but that is just where I got my start. And one more thing, let me back up and say that the word Kentucky, where we live at, I got to researching it, and I'd always heard it was called the dark and bloody ground by the Cherokee, and that's true, but that's not the first usage of that word. The first time that I can find that the word Kentucky was uttered was by the Wyandant Indians. It's W-Y-N-N-D-A-N-T, and they're a subculture of the Hurons up north.
Okay.
And their word for the word Kentucky to them means grassland, the same as prairie means grassland in France.
Gotcha.
So one other diary that I was able to get my hands on was from a group called the Michigan Hunters, and they kept talking about getting with different bands of Native Americans and coming south to Kentucky to the grassland where the buffalo herds were. And they're not as large an expanse as the Midwestern buffalo herds, but we still had these great big herds. And their preferred method of hunting was to go in a circle, about a 5 mile radius circle, lighting fires. And that circle, whenever we light a fire in a field, it draws inward, it creates a chimney effect. And whatever animals didn't die from the smoke inhalation or just from the fire were easily picked off. And that's why the prairies were open. They kept burning them, one to draw the buffalo, two for hunting. And so we've got this mecca, and I've got all the resources we need. And that's basically how we got our start here at Roundstone. So it's not just Roundstone seed, it's primarily Roundstone native seed. And as of today, I have a little over 2,000 acres in production, depending on the year, 200 to 250 different species of native grasses, wildflowers, and wetland plants. But it's not just here. I also raise seed in 7 other states.
Oh, my goodness. I had no idea.
I replicate what I did here in other states. So if it comes from the coastal plain, it has to be grown in the coastal plain.
Okay.
There's a frost date difference. So if I bring it south to north, it may grow, it may prosper, it may do awesome, perform well, but it may not have time to produce a good, viable seed source.
So you have contracts with different farmers in different regions? Or?
Well, somewhat, but unfortunately, that's not worked out that well for us, so we still do the lion's share of the work. We're still on the road. We're kind of like road warriors. We spend a lot of time going to other places and doing the work, but I do have good partnerships. I've got one full-time guy in Georgia who runs 3 different areas for us down there. He does a great job, named Cody Bridges, and he's kind of a lone ranger down there for us. And then I deal with a group of farmers in Arkansas that does similar, one guy in South Carolina. We wildland harvest still to this day in Florida, where I can go on military installation bases. We might hand pick seed, we might put small equipment on it, and that sort of thing.
Fascinating. Well, John, I first learned about you through Dwayne Estes at Austin Peay State University. And of course, my listeners will know about Dwayne and his Southeastern Grasslands Initiative program that he does based there at Austin Peay. And like you described, he's so interested in the historical record of what, you know, what the early settlers, the true pioneers saw on the landscape when they first came across the mountain. And of course, Dwayne talks about the myth of the squirrel, and the being, yeah. being you know the you've heard the story of you're smiling and laughing, but because you've heard it many times from Dwayne and others.
But, I believe the story for a long time.
You know, the myth is that a squirrel could travel through the trees, you know, across Tennessee and Kentucky and never touch the ground. Well, that was a myth, and a lot of what was here in the early days, before white man, so to speak, was grassland, as you described in the barrens of Kentucky, and I guess the Pennyroyal Plain Pennyroyal Barren as it was called.
Yes.
And so the birds and wildlife in this vicinity are adapted to those ecosystems. So that this is why the interest in restoring native grasslands. I'm fascinated by growing, you know, 300 species of grasses and native plants seed. How do you go about growing acres of little blue stem or big blue stem? Is it a monoculture type of a production, or do you have it out there with other species?
Okay, so I've told people several times, I've been usually asked two questions. One, how'd you get into this? And my answer to that's usually, I didn't know any better. The other part, you know, it's a difficult one. I say, well, it's not rocket science. It's a lot tougher than that. So you're looking at, oh boy, it's just, I came up farming. I like to work hard. I like to think about things. My daddy instilled a great work ethic, and he also instilled that we got to think about things and think outside of the box. So when we deal with these plants, there is no book. We have to learn as we go, and the best way to do that is to mimic nature. So if I go out and I hand collect seed from a wildland stand, I'm not just picking seed. I have to determine if it's viable, if it's ripe, if it's got midges or bugs in it, or if it's got smuts to it. And so we bite test seed. We can tell if seed is viable by biting it after you do it so long. So we're in the wild, and we gather all the seed, and we try to do it in a pure form. And then I have to take that raw seed. I have to clean it, condition it, get it to the point that I can plant it. And most of the time I do that in the form of plug. So I'll take this seed, and I normally do like a regional collection. So I don't just go to one small patch and get that seed. I go to an area, maybe it's a 3-county wide area, and collect from other plants. I combine those seeds together. I put them in a greenhouse, and I raise plugs. And I raise about 11,000 plugs per acre. I will go set nurseries of the initial seed I collected. Then I either hand harvest that seed, or I might combine it with some type of machinery or a vacuum or just whatever we do with it. And then that will enable me to have that collection, the offspring of wind pollinated species, to have all this genetic diversity. And then I plant a larger field with that. So yes, to answer your question, most everything I do is in a monoculture stand. It is a single species, which is a great way to learn about species and how they act and when they ripen and all those good things about them. The downside is that when you're in a monoculture, a lot of times they're more susceptible to diseases,
sure,
insects and things like that. But I have to go by federal and state seed regulatory laws. And so in truth, when inspected, if I had weed seeds in it, I could be told you are legally unable to harvest this, or there are not.
I see. So if you have a field that's got some weeds and you get some of that weed seed in mixed in with your good seed, then you got a real problem.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's not just weed seed. Maybe it's other crop seed. Maybe I'm dealing with a particular wildflower, and I've got other wildflowers in there. When I go to sell it, it's truth in labeling. There's the business side of it, and the regulatory side of it is almost nightmarish. But it helps us be better farmers. It helps us to make sure what we do, that we go out there and we pull the weeds and we pick the weeds and we mow in between and we take care and we do our best not to use any more herbicides or pesticides and if we don't have to. So it's each species has its own regimen of how we raise it and what we do with it, if we water it, if we don't, and how we harvest it, how we clean it, and that sort of thing. So,
you know, you made an observation that growing these plants in isolation is a great way to learn about the particular species. because I'll share this with you. I bought some seed from you, from your operation last year, last fall. Yes. I bought a jar of little blue stem and a jar of big blue stem, and I set them out in small plots in what is ordinarily my vegetable garden, about a 20-foot by 3-foot plot of each. And it was fascinating to do and to learn about how those things grow. I don't think I could have identified big blue stem in the wild if my life depended on it a year ago. But now I am thoroughly familiar with it and the look of it. It was a fascinating thing. And one of the things, and I will urge my listeners to go to your website at roundstoneseed.com, because you have a wonderful little handout, free handout about how to establish these grasses and forbs for conservation and other purposes. And one of the things I learned was that that these seeds have to be sown very shallow. I think it was 1/4 inch or 1/8 inch. And if you Absolutely. Go deeper than that, they're just not going to work.
That's right.
And of course, weed control, when these are first set out, is critical. And in my vegetable garden, of course, I had all the crabgrass and all that kind of stuff that comes up, in a garden. I had to be real thorough about getting that out of there to have an effective stand. But boy, these seeds were super productive. I don't think I had much failure of the seed at all, if any. I had to wait for the soil temperatures to get warm enough for that to go. But boy, when they started out, they're just doing great right now.
Well, I'm glad to hear. You know, with what I do, it's a lot of assurances and a lot of phone calls, and I often preach worst case scenario because of the nature of what natives do. And the old adage is that first they sleep, then they creep, then they leap.
So okay.
Sleep, creep, leap. So Got you're it. Taking a seed from the wild, like I keep referring back to things like wheat, oats, and soybeans. They've been bred for specific traits, and they basically have a 14-day germination window. That is to say, if we plant the seed today and it rains today, that if they're going to come up, they will come up within 14 days, a lot of them within a few days. But natives have never been bred to be anything other than resilient. So nature's way is to, when they drop seed, to have some seeds that germinate quickly, some that may germinate a month down the road, some 2, some 3. So a lot of times we have a 70 to 80 day germination window, where other things only have 2 weeks. And then also we have a strong degree of dormancy that's built into those, maybe 20-30%. So when people buy seed from us, we take the best care we can in raising it and keeping it clean and all that, but I cannot change how it acts. And so when it does sprout, if it has all that competition, that weedy competition can smother it. Even though they're hardy plants, they're still babies when they're babies. So the first year, when I say they sleep, basically what they're doing is they put up a little shoot, maybe just a few inches tall, and then they could develop a root system, a fibrous root system, 3 to 4 feet deep that year. And then the next year is when they start putting on top growth, and by the third year is in their pinnacle year. So I'm always overly cautious in telling people that, be patient, because if you don't know what you're looking for, you don't think you have a stand. It's not like sowing a yard or a zinnia garden, that sort of thing.
Right. John, I was at yesterday, actually, at Dunbar Cave State Park here in Tennessee,
yeah,
which is a nice area there near Clarksville, Tennessee. And I had visited the property where you and Dwayne and David put out that, I guess it's 100 acres or so, or is it that much?
No, at Dunbar, it's not quite so much.
Okay.
Maybe you're referencing Google Prairie. We did a much larger area.
Okay. Well, yeah. Anyway, I did go by and looked from the road at the native grass prairie area that was created there. on the backside of the park. And man, is it is just looking great. And the manager there was telling me that they had used a little bit of fire last year and have gotten rid of some of the Johnson grass that was troubling them. But tell us, that's an example of a project that many people would be familiar with. Are there other projects around the state that you could point to illustrate what your product is, what your company is doing?
Yeah. So with what we do, you know, we talk about the species I raise, but let me step back just a touch before I answer your question. So when I go into a prairie to do the hand collection, I'm not just there to pick seed. I might be opportunistic, but we do a botanical survey and we see what's there. All right, man, I walk in this place and there's 115 different species. So what percentage of each species is there? That's valuable information because, yes, I'm raising all these species in monoculture stands, but then I have to develop a mix. I'm trying to mimic nature, or maybe I want to do the best I can for quail habitat or deer habitat or conservation or just diversity, or maybe for pollinators. So I have all these goals that different people for different jobs or different restoration jobs want us to hit. So that's information I have to have. And then the types of restoration that we do are things like Dunbar Cave. And that is a job of passion, to be honest with you. And you keep referencing Dwayne, and that's somebody I think a lot of, and he's been coined as the prairie preacher on numerous occasions. And when I say a job of passion, and he's like me, it can't all be about making a dollar. There's got to be some good in something you do. And so he and I got aligned, and we just wanted to do that project, both of us, because he was bringing something to the table too, in that he's getting the word out there. I knew he would do it right. And then he had other seeds that I did not have that he put in for diversity as well. So that is one type of project we do.
How many different species of seed would have been in the mix of that particular project?
I don't recall right off the top of my head, but he's a purist, and I mean that in a good way. So
right.
He only wanted us to supply the seeds we could supply him that came from the general area that came from, as close as possible, that true ecotype. And,
right.
And then he put more in. So I'd say we're probably hitting 80 species or so.
Wow.
In that one prairie.
Right.
And then some things come in on their own if it's in that seed bank. We create an environment and we nurture the other things that are already there as well.
There was a new park that came online here in Tennessee several years ago called Seven Islands State Birding Park.
Yes.
And that is an area just to the east of Knoxville, Tennessee, along the French Broad River.
That's
beautiful.
Right.
Beautiful area, which I understand had been a dairy farm historically, with the fescue grasses and the rye grasses that you would ordinarily see for the cattle or for the cows. And that area has been converted to a grassland. Were you all involved in that project, or do you?
Yes, absolutely. We did supply the seed for that project, and most of the time when we sell seed, we also try and collaborate, whether asked to or not. So it's imperative for us to make sure things are done right. But when I deal with a lot of the agency folks, they already know, but we can always tell them what not to do. Listen, you know, we've been doing it this way or this type of herbicide prior to planting. And
well, tell us about that now so that the lay audience that's not involved in this on the daily will understand what you're talking about, using herbicide before. What does that mean?
Okay, so before I answer that, I'm going to tell you this. I hate herbicides.
All right.
I have to use them. They, to me, are a necessary evil. So when I go to restore ground, I put prairie back, not necessarily restoration and creation are two different things. Oftentimes we create. So I'm taking something like that cattle farm you talked about, that dairy farm, and I'm not competing with other natives. I'm going in with introduced plants. The orchard grass is introduced. Most of our fescues are introduced. Alfalfa comes from Iran, Johnson grass from Africa, and all these non-native and these invasive plants. So for lack of a better term, what we do is kind of like chemotherapy. We have to get rid of the bad before we can have the good. And no, I don't want to use herbicides, but I'm going to use them, and I'm going to use them aggressively right before I start, so I can get a clean slate to start from that my plants, who are slow to establish, can have the opportunity to come up, and then they will be not necessarily aggressive, but they will be dominant and they can hold their own there. And so to do this, oftentimes the best case scenario is that we have to go in the spring when when the weeds or those introduced plants are actively growing 8-10 inches tall, I would have to herbicide that and do what we call a burn down to do a broad spectrum kill. Then when I do that, kill that sod off, I'm going to release the disturbed ground plants that are in the seed bank. The seed bank is laden with seed. And that's things like crabgrass and foxtail and Johnson grass and Sericea lespediza. So then I will have to do a second herbicide and I'll let that get 8-10 inches that way there's no erosion. Then I will kill that with as tame a herbicide as I can use. And oftentimes I have to do a third one, maybe a cover crop through the winter and possibly even a fourth one in the spring. But once I've done that, once I've killed what's there, worked on the weed seeds that are in the seed bank, then I can interseed into that with a no-till drill, and then I can create the kind of prairie, restore the kind of prairie that we're looking for.
Well, it's a remarkable process and a success story. Speaking of Seven Islands State Birding Park, which had been, as I said, a dairy farm, you can now go there and hear the sound of the bobwhite quail. If you build it, they will come. And the same is true of nature. If you provide the habitat for them, somehow those birds find it.
Absolutely. And even if I design a mix specifically for a specific type of animal, mammal, bird, whatever, there's so many crossover species, it tends to benefit everything.
So I want to go to another topic, because we're getting short on time here. Your business is diversifying in a new direction with the growing of botanicals. Tell us what that is and a little bit about that.
Okay, so again, the word you used was to diversify, and I continue right. to try and do that, and I really like to grow things. So we've got a great company here. They're actually a Canadian company that came to Kentucky, and it is Champion Pet Foods. And basically what they do is they do a really good job of making pet food that is as healthy as it possibly can be. They use all the FDA regulations just like it was for human consumption, and they hold us accountable to that too. Everything pure form, whether it be they've got growers for lamb or wild boar or geese or for somebody like me who is a botanical producer. So what I grow for them are things like Althea root or chicory root, rose hips, and some of those things I've been able to do good at, and some of them I've not. So the things I can't grow, like turmeric, I have worked with other peoples in South Georgia, then I've got them to grow the turmeric so I can use it for. So I supply their botanicals, grow as much as I can and supply the rest. But along with the botanicals I grow, it's kind of opened another door of something of great interest to me. And, people don't have to buy what I sell. They buy it because they want it. So what I'd like to grow is food. I'm a farmer. I really like to farm. I like the fiscal side of that. So there's plenty of food out there in America where we're so blessed, but the things I'm most interested in are the native plants that were here pre-European settlement that the Native Americans consumed. So those are the types of plants that I'm working on right now. Things like marsh elder or amaranth, some of the native corns, some of the native beans.
So amaranth would have been a grain type of a
yes,
grain substitute, so to speak.
Absolutely, yeah. And then so when we see the overhangs, the cliff dwellings, and all the research from the Cahokia Mounds where they've got pottery, and we know what their diets were and the percentages that they ate in. So that's a void that nobody's filling right now. It's something I'm really interested in, and it's all stuff that I can utilize the tools that I have to go out in the wild and can collect. But for the first time, I'll be collecting not for genetic diversity, but for taste and for
so interesting
availability for consumption. So one of the things on the horizon that I'm really excited about right now.
John, I'm trying to imagine in my mind's eye growing rose hips, and I know what they are. I mean, is there a specific species of rose that you're growing to that has suitable hips that are large enough for certain qualities that you like?
Well, it just so happens that the rugosa rose is, which is rough rose.
The native rose, yes.
And so, to be honest, I'm not who I want to be there yet. So I am growing rose hips and supplying part of it, but I've had a hard time getting as much as I need. So we've had some setbacks, a herbicide drift 1 year and then a bad crop 1 year. So to do this has been a learning curve for me. It's not equipment we've done before. So a lot of that's hand picking, hand harvesting.
Goodness.
Champion Pet Foods, they're good to me, but at the same time, they want to make sure that I maintain a level of purity. And so that's what we're striving for. So I'm a work in progress.
Well, absolutely. That's just fascinating. Do you have acres of roses at this point, or are you just getting?
No, I started out with about 5 acres.
My goodness.
They've not grown as quickly as we'd hoped. So we think part of that soil type, but it's all just a learning process for us.
Sure. Fantastic. Now for the home gardener, what sorts of products do you have for the home gardener?
So we talked about our restoration projects, mimicking nature and that sort of thing. We talk about, I do a lot of mixes specifically for pollinators. If people want honeybees,
there you
or monarch
go.
Butterflies,
there you go. There you
a
go.
Lot of that's backyard habitat type stuff. And then, I sell a lot of the native grasses strictly for forage, for silage and haylage and pastures and things. But for the type of person we're talking about, then we've got all these different blends and mixes that we've worked really hard on to put together. And we change them every so many years, depending on what we see, what we learn, and new plants that we have come available. So for backyard habitat, you don't have to have 100 acres. You can make a difference in a small area with a few packets worth of seed. And it's something you can baby, and you can see all the different invertebrates, all the different pollinators that come, all the different small mammals, all the different birds. So those are some of the most gratifying phone calls I get. When people call in to just tell me what they saw in their backyard sometimes.
Fantastic. John, I told you that I had purchased some seed from you last year, and I was concerned that my order was going to be too small to be an order that you guys would be interested in, because I was ordering like half an ounce of, or maybe an ounce of a particular seed, which, is like a ball jar full. I mean, it's a lot of seed in an ounce.
Yes.
But I have to tell you, I was very happy that you fulfilled the order with no questions asked. It came on time. It was nicely packaged. All the aspects of it were first class, and that's a testament to you. And an encouragement for my listeners to get in touch with y'all and look and see what you have. They're good to do business with.
Well, thank you for the accolades. It just tells me that I've got a really good team. And to be honest, there's no such thing as too large or too small. That's not the question you ask when you answer the phone. And we're not very good salesmen, but we like to grow seeds, so we like to talk about seeds. I've been at the point in my life, Mark, I've just been very grateful to sell anything. So. We're grateful for any orders we get, and hope that with what we sell, we can do a little good in the world at the same time.
John, it's interesting that you would occupy this space in the conservation movement and in the economy. But you've created a bunch of jobs.
We do. We've been very blessed. I grew up in Hart County, which was the number two burley tobacco producing county in the state. And, Kentucky was number one in burley.
In the world, yes. Absolutely.
We had a labor force and a workforce, and that dynamic has changed. I still live in a rural community, but a lot of people don't farm, don't come up farming. So I've been able to absorb a lot of the young men and women that still are inclined that way. So we keep, right now, I think I've got about 36 full-time employees, and I use a lot of migrant help, and then we have a lot of interns come through, and we encourage and welcome that as well.
Super. John, it's been a joy to speak with you. I think we could go on and on for a long conversation, but of course the media that we have here has its limits. So I thank you for joining me today. Encourage my listeners to check you all out. Thanks, John.
Thank you so much, and thanks for having me. I really enjoyed it.